friends. I'm Diane Rehm. Tomorrow, Iran celebrates the 31st anniversary of its Islamic Revolution, a day that in the past was marked by celebration, will instead be watched by the world for signs of just how strong the opposition Green Movement is. Some expect millions to take to the streets and fear a violent crackdown by government forces. Joining me to talk about what might happen tomorrow and the latest on Iran's nuclear ambitions, Robin Wright with the United States Institute of Peace and David Albright with the Institute for Science and International Security. We'll have other guests join us throughout the hour. A day in Washington and surrounding areas that has been shut down because of a blizzard. So all of our guests are on the phone. Good morning to you, Robin. And good morning to you, David.
Good morning.
Thanks for joining us. And we do invite our guests around the country, around the world, to join us as well. 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. David, Iran is claiming it will soon start producing higher-grade nuclear fuel. What does that mean to you?
Well, Iran has said that that process started yesterday, that their surprise was that they were ready to yesterday to start enriching from a lower grade, 3.5% enriched uranium, up to 20%, and they did it in front of the International Atomic Energy Agency inspectors. What it means is essentially Iran's going up the next rung of a ladder toward the ability to produce material weapon-grade uranium that could be used in nuclear weapons. And it, while this effort may be couched in a debate over should Iran provide fuel for a research reactor that would make medical isotopes, the real story is Iran moving to increase its ability to make nuclear weapons. One of the problems Iran faces is it doesn't know how to make the fuel for the reactor. It's dependent on imports of that fuel. It's a little tricky to make it. So Iranian officials have even admitted that if they go this route, they're not going to be able to produce new fuel in time to meet the expected shortages in medical isotopes.
David Albright, he's a former UN nuclear weapons inspector. He's president of the Institute for Science and International Security. Robin Wright, Iran continues to insist its program is for research and peaceful purposes, but now Secretary of Defense Gates is calling for sanctions on Iran in weeks, not months. How do you jibe those two things?
Well, Iran has long claimed that its intent was only peaceful, but the reality is it lied for 18 years to the international community about a secret program, and it has still refused to answer the final round of questions about what it was doing and why and where its facilities were. And, of course, recently the United States revealed that it found a secret new facility built outside Tehran in the holy city of Qom, which has added to the concerns about Iran's ability to tell the truth. The United States during the past year has attempted a diplomatic outreach to Iran to say, we will help you get access to the fuel you need for this medical research, what it's talking about now, the fuel cycle it's now said it's going to do itself, which would have allowed an opportunity for Iran and the outside community to talk about a wider range of issues, would have deferred its ability to increase its uranium enrichment, the purity levels. And Iran turned down this deal, and so the United States has said it's time now to think about sanctions. And there is a draft resolution making the rounds in New York among the permanent members, trying to sort out how far they can all go together. The United States and the European Union are so far in agreement on the scope of sanctions, particularly targeting the Revolutionary Guards, their businesses, which are now quite extensive in Iran, as well as any operations that are suspected to be linked to any weapons of mass destruction program. The issue now is whether the United States can get China particularly to sign on, because China has a deepening relationship with Iran, deepening reliance on Iranian oil, and China also has its own kind of worldly ambitions and is using Iran as one of those issues to show just how important it is.
Robin Wright, she's a journalist, author, and foreign policy analyst at the U.S. Institute of Peace. Her most recent book is Dreams and Shadows, The Future of the Middle East. Do join us, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. David Albright, can anyone be really sure of what Iran is trying to do with its nuclear program?
No, in fact, that's part of the problem, is that Iran is very carefully trying to create disguises around its programs that make it look like it's only for civil purposes. And some countries and experts and individuals have reasons to latch on to that. And what Robin said about the inspections is probably should be what guides us. If Iran can't satisfy the International Atomic Energy Agency, which is never very far-leaning on accusations about secret nuclear programs, if they can't satisfy the IA, then the rest of the world should not be satisfied and worry that under this is really a program to get nuclear weapons. Now, Iran may not have decided to build them, but that also makes sense. I mean, Iran isn't going to want to say, okay, we're now going to build nuclear weapons and then have to wait around for 1 or 2 years to be able to make that happen. They're going to want to make a decision to build weapons and be able to do it quickly. And the long pole in the tent of a nuclear weapons effort is producing the enriched uranium to use in a nuclear weapon. And the way Iran would go about it is create a plant that will first produce 3.5% enriched uranium, take the 3.5%, turn it into 20%, take the 20%, turn it into 60% enriched uranium, take the 60% and turn it into 90% enriched uranium, which is the level you want for weapons. So they're walking up that ladder, and we can't tell for sure that they're walking up the ladder to nuclear weapons. But I think we have to increasingly assume that that's indeed what is taking place. And all these statements of civil use may also be true. But unfortunately, they're not the only reasons.
At the same time, when you have Secretary Gates calling for sanctions within weeks rather than months, have sanctions ever worked against Iran or any other country other than South Africa, for that matter? David?
Yes, sanctions have worked against other countries. They worked against Libya. Libya gave up its nuclear weapons program, mostly out of the fear of sanctions and the isolation that it caused and the conflict it caused with the United States and the Europeans. So, no, sanctions can work. I mean, but the trouble is they're not fast-acting, and that you have to kind of hunker down and wait it out.
You use the word isolation. As far as Libya was concerned, Iran is already isolated. It doesn't seem to care, at least its leadership does not seem to care very much.
I think the isolation has only started. I mean, Iran's been pretty free to buy things internationally until recently, and so I think the isolation is going to start soon, we'll see if it can work. But the sanctions so far have been largely, they look robust from the U.S. point of view, but the U.S. has really been the only one who's imposed pretty harsh sanctions on Iran, and so Iran could bypass those pretty easily. In fact, its smuggling networks could pretty effectively buy in the United States for its military programs. So it's you need much many more participants in order to create the isolation. And that's what was created on Libya and also what was created on South Africa.
Robin Wright, in the meantime, how do you see the administration's approach toward Iran changing?
I think there's been a very interesting shift over the past 2 months. In the early stages of the Obama administration, they focused largely on the nuclear program. After the protests began in June following the presidential election, the United States kept that at arm's length. But in December, the administration began talking much more openly about Iran's abuse of human rights, of civil rights. And there have been a series of statements that have expressed concern about Iran's specific Iranian actions, expressing sympathy for the death of the leading dissident cleric, which in many ways is an unprecedented statement since the disruption of relations between the two countries in 1979. And just this week, the United States and the European Union issued a joint statement, which again is unprecedented, is expressing concern about the extraordinary number of detentions, the threatened execution of protesters, the intimidation of family members of those who are detained and who dare to get out and protest or write letters to the government and publish them, the denial of basic rights of freedom of expression and right to assembly. And it called on the government in the run-up to the anniversary tomorrow to live up to international human rights obligations.
All right, and we'll take just a short break here. When we come back, we'll talk more with our guests. Take your calls, your email. Stay with us. Welcome back. As we talk about the 31st anniversary of the Islamic Revolution, tomorrow Iran will celebrate that. Millions are expected to march in the street. There are concerns as to whether there might be a crackdown and indeed violence. I wonder, Robin Wright, what you expect to see tomorrow in the streets of Tehran.
I think both the Iranian regime and the new opposition Green Movement are likely to pull out all stops to try to show that they have the larger following. The regime would be most embarrassed of all the demonstrations so far since the June 12th election if the protesters end up taking over the anniversary of the revolution. This would take move the whole protest movement into a new phase. We've seen in June the issue was allegations of a fraudulent election. In the fall, we began to see the issue emerge on a broader plane as protesters demanded a change in the leadership at the very top, the supreme leader, not just the president. And this would, if the protesters dominate the day tomorrow, would for the first time begin to look like a counter-revolution, even though their demands are still rather limited.
And joining us now is Karim Sajjadpour. He's associate at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. Good morning, Karim.
Good morning, Diane.
I was asking Robin what she expects to see in the streets tomorrow in Iran if the Green Movement does decide to stage a huge protest?
You know, Diane, the crowd size has always exceeded my expectations in terms of the opposition turnout, simply because the regime does a good job of creating an atmosphere of tremendous fear and terror. And in advance of these protests, they've been warning people that there could be severe repercussions. Their security is in their own hands if they attend these protests. So on one hand, the people I talk to in Tehran have said that they are planning on attending. So I do expect a large turnout. But on the other hand, I think that simply counting heads can be a somewhat misleading barometer of the popular mood in Iran. Because I have no doubts that if people were allowed to freely assemble, you could see crowds of upwards of 5-6 million in Tehran and certainly millions more in other urban centers throughout Iran.
And how is the Iranian regime likely to react to crowds of that size, Karim?
What they're going to do certainly tomorrow is to bus in their own supporters. They do have a small hardline constituency, but they do a pretty good job of busing in people from the provinces and promising them meals. So they will show their own crowd numbers. But it will really depend on how the opposition supporters decide to differentiate themselves from the regime supporters. I think that people who are openly wearing the color green, the color of the opposition, people who are openly chanting slogans against the supreme leader, Ayatollah Khamenei, I'm sure that they risk violence being inflicted upon them.
What do they want, Karim? What are they marching for?
I think, Diane, that there exists a generational and a worldview gap between some of the leadership of the opposition, people like Mir Hossein Mousavi, the former prime minister, and Mehdi Karoubi, the former Speaker of the Parliament, and kind of the younger foot soldiers of the opposition movement. I think the leadership of the opposition movement has long made it clear that they're trying to work within the confines of the Constitution. They don't seek a revolution or a wholesale change of the regime, but they want to see some major remodeling of the Islamic Republic. And I think the younger generation seeks far more sweeping change. As Robin was alluding to earlier, they're not only calling for the removal of President Ahmadinejad. They would like to see the removal of the supreme leader, Ayatollah Khamenei. I think they would even like to see the removal of the institution of supreme leader. They say that this is simply a modern-day king. He's a king who wears a turban instead of a crown. And I think the way the regime has reacted to the opposition with such a heavy hand has actually somewhat narrowed this gap between the leadership of the opposition and the young foot soldiers, but this gap still does exist.
Do you actually believe there could be violence in the streets if the numbers turn out to be as large as you suggest?
I expect, unfortunately, that we will see violence, and part of the reason why is that the regime's kind of shock troops, the besieged militiamen, they're oftentimes undisciplined and unruly, and they are simply trying to create this atmosphere of fear and terror. So I think that if the opposition supporters come out and are wearing green and masks and chanting slogans against the supreme leader, and the numbers are quite high, I have no doubt that that the regime will react by trying to inflict major violence upon them.
Karim Sajjadpour of the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. Here's an email from Charlotte, North Carolina. Massey asks, in regard to Iran, I understand why China might not want more sanctions against Iran, but what are the reasons for Russia's hesitancy to enact sanctions? I've heard they are helping build the medical research hospital where the supposed enriched nuclear material would be used. David Albright, is this true?
I don't know about this hospital, but the isotopes that Iran uses, some come from overseas, some come from that research reactor. Any hospital would be set up to use wherever any isotopes that come from anywhere. So I don't think there's a strong linkage between the research reactor and the medical isotope usage in Iran. And I think that leakage will weaken, actually, because of Iran's current path. Because, again, it just doesn't know how to make the fuel. And so that's going to take time. In terms of Russia, Russia certainly has very great commercial interests in Iran. It still sees itself playing some kind of pushback with the United States in the region. And it's for the last 10, 20 years, it's had a warm relationship with Iran. So I think it has incentives to not see sanctions. But that being said, in the last year, Russia has been changing, and they've been disturbed by Iranian activities. And they, again, were disturbed by this announcement by Iran to go to 20%, because increasingly the Russians are seeing that Iran is on this path toward a nuclear weapons capability and very likely an attempt to build nuclear weapons.
Well, then the question would become, why has the U.S. not pushed harder on Russia? We keep hearing about China sort of blocking these sanctions, but why not push harder on Russia?
Well, it's hard to know what pushing harder means. I mean, you can't just bully Russia or China into backing sanctions. You have to convince them that it's in their interest to do it, or not doing it has costs that they don't want to pay. And so right now with Russia, I think they are coming on board for more on the sanctions, but I don't think they're there yet. China is pushing back harder. I mean, I think they're going to be the problem, and they may be why sanctions on this round in the Security Council get weakened.
And for you, Robin, here's an email from Ellen in Fort Lauderdale, who says when this administration campaigned for the presidency, it criticized the previous administration for its failure in utilizing diplomacy to resolve issues with Iran. Please comment on how the current administration is doing in that regard and what they propose in the event diplomacy and sanctions do not work.
Well, the Obama administration has spent more than a year now actively pursuing diplomatic options. And even as it talks about imposing new sanctions, it continues to stress that the diplomatic option remains open. It's not being taken off the table, and Iran at any moment can accept the offer to engage. So there's a different tone to the kind of approach the Obama administration has taken so far.
Then there is, of course, the concerns as to whether sanctions would actually play right into the hands of the Iranian government, Kareem.
I think, Diane, that if we take a look at how the Obama administration was framing sanctions, say, last year, they were looking at it almost exclusively in the context of how might sanctions and other punitive measures alter the Iranian government's nuclear calculations. In the aftermath of these elections now, they're increasingly looking at sanctions and punitive measures in the context of Iran's internal political dynamics. And they're thinking, you know, how might these measures be potentially helpful or harmful to the cause of democratic reform in Iran? And I think if you listen to Secretary Clinton in particular, a year ago she was using the word, quote-unquote, crippling sanctions. Now they're using the word targeted sanctions. And increasingly, the entity which they're trying to target in Iran is the Revolutionary Guard Corps, because the Revolutionary Guard Corps are the entity which is overseeing the brutalization of the Iranian population. They're the ones who are managing Iran's nuclear program, and they're the ones who are liaising with extremist groups throughout the Middle East, like Hamas and Hezbollah. So I think the Revolutionary Guard Corps, China and Russia may well come on to sanctions against the Revolutionary Guards at the UN. And I think the Europeans, even countries like Scandinavia, may come on board to sanctions against the Revolutionary Guards for their human rights abuses.
Now, I'd like to ask you all about a piece that appeared in the New York Times yesterday, written by Adam Lowther. He is a defense analyst at the Air Force Research Institute. We've tried to reach him this morning. Apparently, he is in Europe, so we've been unsuccessful. He said in his op-ed piece that, in fact, there are potential benefits to the U.S. should Iran build a bomb. He talks about the fact that it would give the U.S. an opportunity to finally defeat violent Sunni Arab terrorists like al-Qaeda. I'd like your reactions, Robin.
Well, I found the conclusions involved an almost wild leap of faith. He suggests that the United States could offer our Gulf allies a nuclear shield, and that by so doing that, these regimes would feel so grateful that they would introduce widespread economic, political, and social reforms. And I'm seriously skeptical that regimes feeling increasingly vulnerable would at that juncture decide to begin to open up. He also says that suggests that the Palestinians, because Iran's nuclear program might target Israel, which would have a spillover effect on the Palestinians, might then be so concerned that they would engage in reconciliation, more serious reconciliation efforts with the Israelis. You know, he's going against the entire history of the region and the pattern of governments reacting, whether they're in the Middle East or beyond.
Robin Wright, and you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. And David Albright, I'd be interested in your comments.
Well, one thing I agreed with was that we're headed toward what I'd call a mini Cold War with Iran. It seems almost inevitable right now. And there are some benefits, clearly, and I think authors pointed those out. Again, I agree with Robin. He may be stretching a bit, but he's ignoring the downsides and also that it is a war, even though it's not a fought with weapons. And he ignores that, you know, one of the real issues that we're going to face is trying to keep others from seeking nuclear weapons, whether it's Saudi Arabia, Egypt, Turkey. I mean, there's ways to do it, but we're going to have to tend to that a lot more. There's also going to be more instability that could lead to a military conflict. And finally, we don't know what Israel's going to do. And Israel may perceive that its existence is so threatened that it's going to strike even if Iran has nuclear weapons. It may just decide that maybe it'll learn where those are. Maybe it'll feel if it only has one or two, they have to strike. But the final point is that if it is a mini Cold War, we didn't accept that in the Cold War with Russia, that we just accept the status quo forever. And so the point of it is to in a sense win, and the winning involves a fundamental change in the regime's nature and the end of its nuclear weapons program.
If sanctions do not work, if negotiations do not work, are all options on the table, David?
I don't think so. No, I think we should do everything we can to avoid an actual military strike against Iran. I think in fact, one of the things the Obama administration's done, and it was also being done in the last part of the Bush administration, is try to, you know, of course, not take the military option off the table, but kind of push it into a corner and say, look, you know, that's not what we're planning, and please keep us from going there.
All right. And Kareem, before we take a break, tell us what role you think the U.S. should be playing in terms of the protesters who come out tomorrow.
I think, Diane, that the United States can certainly offer moral support, offer solidarity with the people of Iran. And this isn't in the form of the United States coming out and explicitly endorsing the opposition movement, but they can The United States can talk about universal principles of democracy and human rights and let the Iranian people know that the United States is on the right side of history and wants to see them succeed and wishes them success.
And, Robin, I gather there are a number of emails circulating among demonstrators.
Yes, it's very interesting, the level of organization. They've been, for several days, sending out instructions telling people, for example, to carry a napkin stained with vinegar in a freezer bag in order to fight off the effects of tear gas. It calls on any doctors or nurses or medical students to carry small first aid kits with them. It's telling people to organize bags of rocks and put them outside on the street so that protesters can pick them up if they need to throw rocks at the security forces.
Journalist Robin Wright, we'll take a short break. Your calls when we come back.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the Kiplinger Foundation, supporting public understanding of business and the economy, by the Wallace Foundation, a source of ideas for expanding learning opportunities beyond the school day at wallacefoundation.org, by Jeffrey Kenner, in appreciation of NPR's international coverage and its foreign correspondents, and by PBS, presenting The National Parks, America's Best Idea, from filmmaker Ken Burns, airing tonight at 9, 8 Central on PBS. This is NPR.
More and more people are turning to internet dating services to find a mate. The pros and cons of online matchmaking, what to expect when making a date in the digital age, The Diane Rehm Show. Next hour. Questions, comments about Iran. We'll try to get to as many as we can. Here's one for Kareem Sajjadpour from a senior at Haverford College whose name is Daniel. He says, what choices do you see for the Obama administration to move forward besides pushing for a Fourth Security Council resolution, which is reluctantly supported by Russia, still opposed by China? In some quarters, there have been calls to move the debate to amplifying the human rights issues in Iran itself. For instance, actually debating Iran at the UN Human Rights Council in Geneva. Since the regime has vociferously opposed suspension of enrichment again and again, is there purchase for the administration to amplify the human rights concerns and seek a pragmatic solution to the nuclear issue?
Diana, I haven't seen any evidence in the past of Iran improving its human rights record as a reaction to U.S. Requests or U.S. policies. I would frame the issue like this, that I think the real challenge the Obama administration has is how do you dialogue with the Iranian regime on these urgent national security challenges. And it's not only the nuclear issue. There's also Afghanistan and Iraq, countries in which Iran has tremendous influence. So how do you dialogue with Iran on those issues without betraying the millions of Iranians who think their regime is illegitimate? And I think that a useful template to look at is U.S. policy towards the Soviet Union in the 1980s, at a time when the United States had high-level dialogue with Russian leaders. But at the same time, the United States was very outspoken and vocal about issues like human rights and democracy and civil society. And I think if there's one thing concrete which I can add in terms of how we help the cause of human rights in Iran, and this is something I hear over and over from activists within Iran, is that it would be very useful for the United States, whether it's the United States government or the private sector, to provide technological aid to Iranians to prevent the regime's ability to implement a communications embargo so that Iranians continue to get satellite television from the outside. They continue to be able to connect to the internet and show the outside world what's taking place within Iran.
All right, let's open the phones. We'll go to Charles. He's in St. Louis, Missouri. Good morning. You're on the air.
Good morning. Iran says that we have reneged on the deal to enrich their uranium. I'm wondering exactly what went wrong in that offer, according to them. And you said that sanctions were successful in Libya and South Africa, but apparently they have been unsuccessful in Iran and Korea, so that's a wash. Why would these sanctions be any different, be any more successful, and wouldn't that just give them room to continue to try and avoid any repercussions, go ahead and make the nuclear weapons?
Robin.
Well, look, on the sanctions issue, sanctions are effective in some areas. They were effective in forcing the North Koreans, particularly once the Chinese joined in with its pressure, to join in the diplomatic talks. They have not convinced the North Koreans so far to cooperate, but it has led them to go to the table. You know, there are two different kinds of sanctions. There are punitive sanctions that are imposed after the fact to say, look, you are not cooperating. And then there are those to try, as the United States is now, with targeted sanctions, to go after the entities that are the problem, to try to squeeze the regime and say, look, with diplomacy still on the table, we still want to try to resolve our differences. So I think when we talk about sanctions, there are vastly different kinds of sanctions. Congress has talked about the kind of crippling sanctions earlier in cutting off companies that are helping Iran refine oil. That, you know, has a whole different set of repercussions that could end up rallying some Iranians even around the regime. In terms of the earlier deal that the United States offered, this is one that Iran has offered several different responses to and has never been completely clear. It says no, and then it says, well, yes, it's still on the table, and then it offers its own version that's not acceptable to the international community. And so this is where Iran tries to kind of fudge the issue. It tries to redefine diplomacy on its own terms, and in a way that it knows will not be acceptable to the international community, but is not saying no itself.
All right, to Taylor. He's in Dallas, Texas. Good morning to you.
Hi, Diane.
Hi.
I have a question for the callers, and it was pertaining to a statement that that Ahmadinejad made a few days back. He said that their nation will deliver a harsh blow to the global arrogance, referring to the West, on this year's anniversary of the Islamic Revolution. I was wondering if the guests could speculate as to what that crazy guy could have meant by that.
Kareem.
I think, Diane, that the Iranian government, in particular President Ahmadinejad, has this paradoxical mix of, on one hand, having delusions of grandeur, but on the other hand, being profoundly insecure. And I was thinking back to the show trials which Iran conducted last summer, these Stalinist show trials. And they put a young woman, a petite 22-year-old French girl who happened to be a French language instructor at University of Esfahan, they put her on trial. And they said that this woman is a threat to our national security. And I said, that doesn't project strength. That projects tremendous insecurity and weakness when you put a young girl on trial and says that, you know, this girl is a threat to Iran's national security. So I think that to the credit of the Obama administration, they haven't dignified Ahmadinejad's bombastic comments with a reaction every time. I think it's important for the United States to continue to project the poise and confidence of a superpower and not drop down to Ahmadinejad's level.
Here's an email from Mike in Charlotte, North Carolina, who says, what would the turning point look like in Iran? What will it take for the opposition movement to successfully dislodge the existing regime? It seems as if the opposition movement may be gaining strength, but how does it turn the corner to instate real change in the leadership of the country? David.
Well, it's probably Robin or...
Or Kareem.
Kareem should I'm a little stunned to be asked this question. Don't normally get asked. Let me just quickly say one thing, though, on the nuclear. You'll know it when you see it. I mean, there'll be a change in attitude. There'll be cooperation. There'll be, you know, coming forward with things. But let me turn to others, Kareem and Robin, for a response.
Kareem.
Well, I think if you ask 10 Iran experts for their predictions, you will probably get 10 different sheets of paper from them. But on one hand, I'm very confident about the political maturity of the Iranian population. This is a very young society, Diane. Two-thirds of the country were essentially born after the revolution. And I think that they certainly do strive for a more politically, economically, socially open system. On the other hand, I've never been one to underestimate the regime's penchant for brutality and their willingness to use sheer violence and terror to try to retain power. And I think the goal of the opposition is to try to inch forward and force some types of changes which don't result in violence or civil war. But they're perhaps more gradual and time-consuming than many in the Iranian diaspora would like to see. You know, people who would like to see far more abrupt change.
And now to St. Louis, Missouri. Good morning, Anwar. You're on the air.
Yeah. Good morning, Diane. Good to hear your voice again.
Thank you.
And I just want to have a small comment regarding. I think the main thing is between the United States and Iran. Is the trust. The both countries do not trust each other. You know, talking is, you know, it's like they say, talk is cheap. But, you know, after the Iran-Iraq war, how the Americans support the Iraq, the Sunni government, you know, the minority government and all these hundreds and thousands of people got killed. I remember that very well when I was watching TV here in the States. But I'm just saying that sanctions does not work, really. You know, you have to realize on the ground, Iran is a big country, a lot of population, and now Iraq is also is a part of Iran now because they also have a Shiite government. There are two countries in the world. They are both Shiites, and they are joined together basically with the border and all that. You know, I think the people are good. They're nice people. They love Americans. I know that because I was in that country three times. It's just the government, and I think what it is, going back to Jimmy Carter's time and all the trust and all these things, and I think if that will work out, they could have a very good relationship because the people love Americans.
All right. Thanks for your call, Robin. That question of trust.
Well, it's a very important one, and I've been covering Iran since 1973, and I remember the days when there were 40,000 Americans in Iran where we had a strong Peace Corps contingent, and there still is a very strong pro-American sentiment among the people of Iran generally, young and old alike. The tragedy is that the governments have never been able to reconcile, and it looks no closer today than it did 30 years ago.
All right. We'll take a caller in Fort Wayne, Indiana. Good morning, Doug. You're on the air.
Good morning, Diana. I hope everyone's doing well this morning.
Well, it's a blizzard out there, so we're trying to do as well as we can.
Yeah, I'm in Indiana, so we're seeing a lot of that, too.
Yeah.
My comment or question is that Iran is a sovereign nation. It is recognized by the United Nations, and as I understand, possibly by the United States. If they want nuclear weapons, like Israel and Pakistan and India and Russia, why can't they have them?
Kareem.
Well, I think that a couple concerns immediately come to mind, especially for non-proliferation experts like David Albright. They would say that this, if Iran crosses that nuclear threshold, it could start an arms race throughout the Middle East. Saudi Arabia, Turkey, Egypt, a number of other countries would then want their own nuclear weapon, and this would make certainly the Middle East far more combustible rather than safer. I think another concern is that you have a government in Tehran which openly threatens the existence of Israel, which, as the caller well knows, in the context of domestic U.S. politics, that's an issue with a tremendous amount of support and passion for Israel. So I think from the vantage point of American legislators, the option of Iran crossing that nuclear threshold presents a number of concerns.
Now, Kareem, what about the idea that if Iran did, in fact, have nuclear weapons, the whole region might be indeed more safe because none of those countries is willing to begin the first Holocaust in terms of creating a nuclear war that could spread throughout the world?
You know, Diane, my characterization of the Iranian government is that it is an odious government, certainly towards its own people, but it's not suicidal. The notion that Iran is going to use this weapon to hasten the return of the 12th Imam or the Mahdi, I think is very unlikely. So on one hand, I do think if Iran crosses that nuclear threshold, it's certainly not pleasant, but it's not the end of the world. We live with Mao's China with a nuclear program. We live with the Soviet Union. And I think we'll be able to live with an Iranian nuclear weapon. That being said, I think we should do everything possible to try to deter and prevent that outcome.
Yeah, there's one other part of that, though, that's important to remember. You see it playing out in between India and Pakistan. Not all nuclear arms races are, in a sense, stable, in the sense that they don't lead to nuclear war. Usually it would be by accident, not by one nation deciding to launch a preemptive nuclear strike against the other. And in the Middle East, you could have so many players, particularly if the weapons capabilities spread, that it'd be impossible to really get a good sense of what's going on, and so the chance of it getting out of control would increase.
But, David, wasn't that the argument made during the Cold War? And isn't that precisely what kept the world more or less at peace?
Well, but not in the 50s and 60s. If you remember the Cuban Missile Crisis, that could have very
yes.
well led to a global nuclear war. And there were other points in time where nuclear war was almost expected by our militaries. And so I think it's a very risky road to travel. And I think it's unsafe to think that nuclear weapons make us safe.
And Robin, finally, what do you think we're going to learn from tomorrow's demonstrations?
Well, I think we're going to see the level of resolve and resilience of the protesters. The key, I think, will be whether President Ahmadinejad is able to give his speech. The goal of the protesters is to try to create enough disturbances that it will be repeatedly delayed and potentially even canceled. That's, to them, their primary goal. It's not to see a showdown, any kind of physical confrontation with the Basij or the Revolutionary Guards or the security forces. It's to try to force the regime literally off the stage.
And Kareem, what do you expect?
I think Robin put it very well. And I just would repeat what I said earlier, Diane, that I think it can be a misleading barometer of public opinion in Iran to simply count heads. Because I said, I think certainly if people were allowed to freely assemble, you would have tens of millions of people throughout Iran lining up in favor of the Green Movement.
Kareem Sajjadpour, Robin Wright, David Albright, thank you all so much. And thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Susan Neighbors, Denise Couture, and Monique Nazareth. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dori Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe, and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information.